I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Hi. This is Greg Bresnitz, one half the host of Snacky Tunes. We have had the honor of being nominated by Taste Awards for Best Radio Show and Best Podcast. Please head to bit.do/stvote in order to vote for Snacky Tunes and other food favorites. Once again, that's bit.do/stvote. And a big congratulations to Heritage Radio Network for being nominated into the Hall of Fame. Thanks so much. We really appreciate it.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth, Wisconsin, makers of the world's best cheese and pioneers in the U.S. artisan cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com. Hey everyone, this is David Tatasciore, lead engineer and studio manager of the Heritage Radio Network, and I'm reaching out to ask for your support during our end-of-year fund drive. A contribution in any amount supports our weekly programming and our mission to make the world a more equitable, sustainable, and delicious place. Plus, you'll receive exclusive member benefits like monthly playlists, discounted event tickets, party invitations, and more. So, if you like good food and you love good food radio, throw a little dough our way. Make your gift at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Happy holidays from all of us here at Heritage Radio Network.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Darren Bresnitz, sitting in the legendary... I feel like we can say legendary. say legendary. Providence, with Michael Cimarosti, chef, owner, founder, seafood legend, adopted godson of Neptune.
Yes.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having us here. So, you know... Providence was probably the first restaurant when I was in New York that people spoke about, like, in hushed tones in L.A., even from, you know, years ago. And, you know, what it's been based on is seafood and dedication to the sea and all animals and things like that. But you built a career out of seafood.
Yeah.
What put you in that direction? When did that start?
It started, I guess, like, way, way back when we used to work at Le Cirque when I was a kid. The original Le Cirque on 65th Street.
And define kid.
Kid, like 20, 21, oh,
okay.
22.
So not 12. Not 12.
But I wish I had started there when I was 12. But, you know, I worked there for a while, started out on the grill like most cooks do, and then they moved me to the fish station, and I stayed there for maybe a year. And when I was there, you know, as once the chef trusted you, he would allow you to sort of like do your own thing. To a certain extent, there there were menu items that were part of the static menu, but then there were also daily specials that we did, and, you know, every day we'd get some new type of fish. And, you know, and the chef would allow myself and a couple of the other cooks to, like, come up with our own specials. So I started really, like, delving into things there, and then I moved out here. Initially, I was working at Spago, and then...
small little place. Keep your eye on that
the
one.
Old, yeah.
Keep your eye on Spago.
Yeah. Wolfgang, you might just make it one day.
Yeah. He just... I hope.
Yeah.
I hope.
Yeah. He's a hard worker. but... and then I moved to the Water Grill after that, and that was where I really started, like, intensely focusing on fish and seafood, and where I really, you know... sort of like learn the ropes, because honestly, like, I think working with seafood a while, it's very different than, you know, working in a regular restaurant where you know, you're dealing with more poultry and meat and stuff like that. In a sense, like, it's like, it's like working in any other type of restaurant, like aspirational type restaurant,
right?
And I think a lot of what it comes down to, aside from what you do within the four walls of the restaurant, is what comes through the back door and what you're able to get, and you know, and the relationships you're able to build with, whether it's with fishermen or whether it's with you know, really great purveyors, and, you know, building a set of standards so that people, everybody that you deal with, knows exactly what is good enough for you and what's not. And then, you know, from there, once we get the finest stuff that we can get, then we just try not to screw it up or mess with it too much.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I mean, that's probably the most amazing and toughest thing about getting some of the best ingredients in the world, is like to get out of its way sometimes.
And you know, I mean, we've, you know, we've ruined our fair share of fish back here in the restaurant, you know, and then, you know, and obviously, you know, we do our level best to make sure that it never finds its way to the dining room, but
sure,
you know, we have, you know, it's a tricky medium to work with, and it requires a lot of time and a lot of effort and attention. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that we really focus on here, is like trying to just teach our cooks, you know, what is the right way to cook things and what is the wrong way to cook things, and the right way to store things and handle them and butcher them. And, you know, so it's a whole, it is a different discipline in a way.
Yeah. So let's go back. Where'd you grow up?
New Jersey.
New Jersey.
Yeah. Born and raised.
Born and raised.
Mm-hmm.
Boss fan?
No, not really. You know, I don't know where I grew up, and we were all into the Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers and lots. I mean, I was a huge reggae fan.
Really?
I grew up.
What city in Jersey?
A town called Pennington, which is like right, it's 10 minutes from Princeton.
Okay.
So it's, you know, it's.
Did you go to Princeton Record Exchange?
Oh, of course. I lived at Princeton Record Exchange. I dropped thousands of dollars there, like, when I had no money.
Yeah.
I mean, like, my birthday presents as a kid were always, like, a shopping trip to the Princeton Record Exchange.
I mean, that place is legendary.
Yeah, and I still have the record collection to prove it, too.
Yeah.
Mostly almost all reggae, because when I was a kid, like, that was, you know, for me, that was all I pretty much listened to. So I have a giant collection of LPs, you know, some really awesome stuff. Some stuff that, actually, some things that I bought at the Princeton Record Exchange last year, I gave to Ziggy Marley. Ziggy Marley came in with his mother, Rita.
Really?
And, yeah, and you know, I had these old LPs, a lot of them that I bought at the record exchange, and then some that I bought at this little tiny record shop that used to be on St. Mark's Place in Manhattan. And like these you know, mixes from local New York DJs that had taken some of Ziggy's stuff and remixed it and pressed it on the vinyl. And I gave him like four EPs, and I gave him the Island Records box set of Bob Marley's nine Island albums.
That's amazing.
So after he died, they remastered it all. They pressed 10,000 copies of these nine records and put in this beautiful box set with this, you know, with this great, like, you know, pictorial sort of thing.
Yeah.
And there were only 10,000 made, and I've bought two of them now because I gave the first one that I had to Ziggy, still like factory sealed, and then I bought another one to replace it because he came in and I just told him how you know, reggae really helped shape my upbringing and everything, and I brought those LPs and I said, look, I really want you to have these, like, and some of it he'd never heard, some of those EPs
That's
that I
so
bought in
awesome.
New York he'd never heard, and he was like, no, I can't take them. I was like, look, man, you have to take them.
You have to.
Like, it would mean so much to me to know that you have these records in your home.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, it was very cool.
It's amazing to find so many people who are now in this world of food and have that passion, who started with a passion for music, which I think is an easier thing to get into as a kid, as an art form, to be like, I love music, it's so fantastic, it's really awesome, and then be like, slowly progress into the kitchen and into the culinary arts.
Well, I mean, being it's a lot easier to be a music fan than it is to be a chef, you know?
And oh my God.
Doesn't require much.
No.
But a good year and something, you know, and something that you really have latched onto.
Yeah.
But I mean, there are a lot of chefs that are musicians, you know?
Yeah.
Lots and lots.
Oh my God. So many. So many who are just, it's so funny how many, now we see like the chefs who want to be up on stage and the guys up on stage who want to be like in the back of house.
Yeah.
So when did you start? So your grandparents were from New England?
Yep.
And was it, I know that Connie Attends is inspired by their sort of like cooking and approach to food and things like that. So for you, was growing up and eating like that New England like style of seafood, was that just normal for you?
Yeah, I mean, that was my, you know, we spent our summers in Narragansett, Rhode Island with my grandparents, and we, you know, we'd visit there all the time on holidays, and you know, my grandfather taught me how to fish and gave me my, like, the love that I have for the sea. I really trace it back to him. And, you know, so growing up, it was a lot easier to find the kind of food that we serve at Connie Ted's when I was a kid, and it's a lot tougher now. And when you do find it, honestly, like, nowadays when I go back there and I eat at some of the places that I ate at when I was a kid, I realize that I don't know if things have slipped or things have changed or, you know, if the world is just a different place now. And so, like, I still, like, relish eating that food in other places, but a lot of times it's more for nostalgia's sake than anything, you know, not about the preparation and certainly not about the quality of the ingredients. But I don't know, when I was a kid, I think back then, 30 years ago, 35 years ago, like, we didn't have all these systems in place that we have now, and, you know, it was more, you really had to have relationships with fishermen and that kind of stuff to get, you know, your pisser clams or your, you know, your steamers or your, you know, all of that, you know, all that kind of stuff, like, because there wasn't, like, you know, a value-added product that was sitting in somebody's freezer that you could just go and get.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't know, it just seemed very different.
There was more of a direct connection.
And
there was less restaurants, too.
That's true, and I also feel like the food was just more, it was much closer to its roots back then. And nowadays, it's just different. You know, you go to places now that are on the beach and, you know, in Rhode Island or Massachusetts or whatever, and, you know, and they'll be serving, like, salmon that was farm-raised in Norway. You're like, well, how does this have any fucking relevance to where you are
or
what you're doing? It makes no sense. Like,
it's like, no, but we're near the ocean, and this all comes from the same spot. You're like, what?
Yeah, but meanwhile, there's fishermen that are starving or selling their boats because they can't make a living at it anymore. So it's like, It drives me crazy. It's infuriating.
When did you see? So, you know, you've been tied to the sea since a kid. You work your way up into all these restaurants. You're a water girl. When did you see things? When did you notice a change in the way that fish was being, I guess, farmed, raised, caught, things like that? What was the shift when things started going, like, I don't want to say sideways, but maybe
I think it was like the late '90s, and I think it was, you know, there was a period of time like before sustainability was a buzzword that it is now. Mm-hmm. And there was, you know, there was a period of time where everybody like, oh, farm-raised salmon, wow, that's got to be a great thing. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of information out there that might lead you to believe anything but that, you know, that it is a good thing. And then, you know, I think everybody just got smarter. Information became easier to come by. And, you know, and I think people just in general began to realize that maybe this isn't the next best thing, you know, since sliced bread. And so I think that's probably, you know, late 90s, I think that's probably when the turnaround happened. And then, you know, honestly, for me, I just feel like, as I said before, so much of what we do here is about relationships. And now, like, having the relationships that I do have mm-hmm. to local fishermen and being able to get local, like, seafood harvested here in Southern California that is, like, coming directly off a fisherman's boat and then coming directly to our door.
Yeah.
That's something special, and that's important. And it's, you know, it's, like, traceable fish should be the future of wild fish. You know, it may not be. We may never get there because it is very difficult to do it on a global scale or even a national scale. It's a very difficult thing to do. But I feel like that is the direction that that the seafood industry needs to trend towards, because that will, you know, that'll ensure that, you know, all of these issues we hear about in the news on a, you know, it seems like on a monthly basis about, you know, seafood fraud and everything else will fall away, you know.
Yeah. So when you start, thinking about opening up your own spot, mm-hmm. which is now 10 years ago,
almost 12.
12 years ago, mm-hmm. when you start thinking about it, did you feel that sustainability had to be a key part of opening the restaurant?
Yes, but I didn't have, like, you know, where we are now at the restaurant and how we buy.
Yeah.
And it is like light years from where we were back then. Yes. And I also had I was a kid and I was young and I was, you know, I came from a French background and worked in France and worked at, you know, one of the best French restaurants in the country. And, you know, we were always getting, you know, wild turbo and wild loup de mer and all these, you know, and we also served our fair share of fish from the Atlantic, but on the East Coast. But, you know, that was what I leaned towards when I was younger. You know what I mean? That kind, those kinds of fish.
Yeah.
And now I'm much more about trying to find, you know, great fish that's from right here in Southern California. Or at least, you know, from, let's say, like, Morro Bay South.
Yeah. All right, well, we're going to take a quick musical break.
Let's do that. What are we playing? What are we listening to?
I don't know. Whatever the engineer picks.
All right.
We used to call it out, and then I realized that I could only remember the same three or four bands every time I got to this moment. So, Dave, whatever you want to play, I'm excited. But it was recorded live on Snacky Tunes. Here on heritageradionetwork.org.
Something we both can agree to.
welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I'm with Chef Michael Cimarosti. How'd I do?
Not bad.
Not bad?
Yeah, I've heard worse.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. We're sitting in Providence, which was recently named, again, the number one restaurant in all of L.A., which is pretty awesome. Right?
It's nice.
It's not a bad day when that
No, it's not. In. It's not at all.
You know, but the restaurant's evolved over the years, and what's also evolved has been this idea of sustainability and the fish that you use. You know, especially as you've gotten more buying power and more notability, more people wanting to bring certain fish your way, and as you've gotten more aware of just focusing on the fish of the region with, like, the Dr. Dish program, can you talk about some of the fishes that you used to use, some of the fishes you use now, and your approach to working with local fishermen and, like, being part of that community and a champion of it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, I mean, honestly, I feel like that, for me, is maybe the most important change that the restaurant's gone through in the last, you know, since we opened.
And when did that change start?
It started a couple years ago.
Okay.
It was started in 2015. But I was talking about it with the founder of Dr. Dish back in Montauk, Long Island, since 2014.
For those who don't know what Dr. Dish is.
Dr. Dish is a subscription-based fishery.
Sure.
That restaurants can join, and what you're agreeing to become a member is that you'll pay a monthly subscription, and you can deem, like, how much fish you want. Like, you'd say, I want 50 pounds a week, 100 pounds a week, 75 pounds, whatever it is. And then we will bring to you your subscription every week, and it'll be locally caught fish. We'll tell you who caught it, where they caught it, how they caught it.
What's its name?
It'll be delivered to you within 24 hours of catch. Much shorter, usually. Like this week, like yesterday, actually, we just got fish from a captain named Eric Hodge, who works up in Santa Barbara. He landed the fish at 5 p.m., and we had it yesterday at 8:30 in the morning.
Get out of here.
Yeah, and it's insane. It's like the fish is, it's the finest quality fish that I've ever worked with, honestly. But
you're beholden to...
Yeah, you take what you... I mean, you take what they catch.
Now, which is different, because so when you're starting out and you're opening this temple to seafood and you're coming from the French background that you have, and like that, you're like, I have an idea of the fish that I want. Mm-hmm. I know that we have the money to buy it.
Right.
This is what we're going to serve. This is how we're going to build...
Right, the menu the around
menu
these things.
And the reputation. Mm-hmm. So when you start to think about sustainability change... Give me an example of a fish that was on there when you started that you no longer work with, and a fish that you would have never considered.
Yeah,
well, but now it's on there.
Perfect example. So when we first opened, we always had turbot on the menu, wild turbot from France.
Delicious.
Yeah, and it was beautiful fish, and we would serve it for two, so you get a big piece. It would come out in the dining room. They would fillet in the dining room, the whole thing. And now we don't do that anymore. So a perfect example of a fish that we replace that with is this beautiful local fish called Vermilion Rock Cod.
Sure.
Which is it's a fairly humble fish, but it is...
Like blue collar, like working background. Like
almost, yeah, exactly, yeah. And but it is one of the most delicious fish that I've ever worked with. And the fact that we can get it less than 24 hours out of the water and have it in our hands is remarkable. And I have the connection back to the fishermen. And I know that, you know, that because we're buying it, and because we're supplying, you know, 10 restaurants in LA with Eric's fish, I know that Eric and his wife and his two kids, whom I've met all of them, are, you know, enjoying hopefully a slightly better life than they were before.
It's like futures, like buying on future, right?
In a way. Yeah, I mean, he's actually now at a point where, like, we're creating, because Dr. Dish is now under the umbrella of Cape Seafood, the fish market that we own.
Yep.
So we're running Dr. Dish with the help of Sarah Rathbone, who is the West Coast founder of Dr. Dish, and we hired it at Cape. So now, if you're buying from Dr. Dish, you're also in a way buying from Cape Seafood. The accolades of the restaurants accumulated and all that stuff and Michelin stars, and I can honestly say that, like, I am as proud of the fact that, like, now we have 10 restaurants that are members of Dr. Dish that are, instead of buying, you know, farm-raised branzino or farm-raised salmon or some fish that was, you know, maybe flown in from the East Coast or Europe, that they're now supporting the lives of local Santa Barbara fishermen.
Which sort of goes back to what you were used to when you were growing up.
Yeah.
With, like, the local connection and things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really what every sort of success in the change in the ecosystem and supply chain is that someone with the buying power, the notoriety. Now, 10 restaurants is not a McDonald's level, but 10 restaurants is
important.
It's important, but it's your name and buying power that's allowing a shift in the way that people approach where they get their products and a change in the way that...
Well, it's, you know, you think about it, it's maybe a, you know, ton or whatever of seafood a week. It's not even, or a month. It's not even that much, but it's like, it's something. It's a start. It's like fully traceable fish. People are going to know exactly where it's coming from, how it was caught, all that stuff. And that is the model that we should need, that we all need to like sort of work to get back to, you know. And that's the model that existed long before, you know, you had these giant industrialized systems to deliver us our food,
right.
You know. And that's, you know, bucking that trend, I think, is something that I think you'll see more and more of. And I'm really happy and really, you know, proud to be a part of it.
My question, I guess, is that because of what you've been able to do here, the small empire that you've been able to grow, that's allows you the freedom to do that. Like, you have the luxury to say, I'm not serving turbo because I have my accolades, I have my notoriety, I know I can make a lesser fish shine. Mm-hmm. What about the restaurants that are not as well known? Like, in their ability to say, like, well, we need soul in the menu because...
Yeah, but, you know, soul. I mean, to me, I also feel like, you know, turbo is what it is because of the story. Or,
sure.
You know, Wagyu beef or Kobe beef is what it is because of the story. You know, the fact that a fish like Vermilion Rock Cod is underappreciated doesn't mean that it doesn't have the same integrity and flavor and, you know, unique attributes that a turbo does. You know what I mean? And it's only because, I mean, like, I was enamored with that fish for so long because of where I came from and what I was taught. But I mean, but now I've grown up and I've learned a little bit more, and I realize that just because something like a fish like the rock cod or black cod or any of the other species that we get from Dr. Dish, just because they're unappreciated and they underappreciated and they don't have that same, you know, sort of cachet that a fish like turbo or lunamera has, it doesn't mean that it's not distinctive and delicious. And I would argue that, like, it doesn't matter you don't have to be a restaurant like Providence to be proud of serving a fish like that, because at the end of the day, it's about, like, quality, integrity, freshness, and flavor.
Yeah.
And these fish, humble though they may be, they deliver on all accounts. So, like, you know, what is not to be proud of, honestly? And it's money going back into the Southern California economy. It's making the lives of American fishermen better. I just did a thing in D.C., where I was invited to be a part of this coalition of chefs that were invited by the Monterey Bay Aquarium to go to the White House and do this event for, it was called the Champions of Change for Sustainable Seafood.
Did you get to cook for the president?
No, not at all. Never even saw him. But it was like this, you know, it was a thing. It was fun. It was great. But there's a fisherman there from, actually he's from Rhode Island. His name is Chris Brown. He has this great small company called Brown Family Seafood. Mm. And one of the points that he made, which I thought was, you know, incredibly deep and profound, was the idea that, like, buying American fish is a patriotic act.
Hmm.
And I think that's so true. Like, and with, you know, I mean, that's true of anything that you buy in the retail or wholesale setting. But you know, to think of it in those terms, like the fact that you're supporting American fishermen, that you're supporting, you know, small businesses owned and run by Americans, or even if they're American immigrants to America, whatever it is, but it's fish that's being caught, you know, under the auspices of, you know, our nation and all of its regulations and all the controls that we put on our fisheries. It is a far better choice for anyone out there to, you know, sort of like focus on buying American fish, because you know what you're getting, you know that it's controlled, and, you know, the big phrase in the sustainability world now is IUU. So, illegal, unreported, and unregulated. Mm-hmm. And there's a ton of fish that's imported from other countries.
And not just fish, there's other seafood, like the shrimp and stuff like
right,
that.
Exactly. When I say fish, I mean that whole thing. But IUU, illegal, unreported, unregulated. And if you're buying American fish, you can assure yourself, for the most part, that the fish you're bringing home has not been caught under any one of those three sort of, you know, circumstances.
Now, you know, part of what it seems like it, beyond just actually doing it and bringing the fish, is like telling the story.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like education and marketing in many ways and things like that. And I know with Cape Seafood and Provisions, you know, there's a lot of, you hear a lot about like artisanal butchers and like local butchers, and that's the thing. But this is a fishmonger of the same way that you want, like, your local, let's say, Meat Hook in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. or something like that. So have you seen, now that you've opened it, a shift in the customer and, like, people coming in and being like, I know now about the fish, I'm going out and spreading the gospel. Like, have you seen people being able to come, not just to the restaurant, but to go buy it, cook it at home, mm-hmm. And the change with, like, spreading it that way? You know, it's like you can...
Yeah, it's been great, you know, and we sell the idea over at Cape is that, you know, the fish that you've enjoyed here or the fish that you've enjoyed at Connie and Ted's is for sale there in the retail setting. We buy from the same sources, same vendors, it's the same level of quality. And so, yeah, I mean, it's been great. One of my favorite things to do is go over there and just stand behind the counter and talk to people about fish and, you know, what they're going to do with it and how they're going to cook it and, you know, recommendations.
What I want every time I go to a supermarket. When I get, like, a piece of fish, 'cause I'm like, okay, I know it was salmon. I can put, like, mm-hmm. mustard and soy on this.
Yeah, like, I mean, you know, this week we had two different kinds of salmon side by side in the case. We had troll caught kings from Sitka, Alaska, which are big fish, you know, fatty, absolutely gorgeous. And then we had smaller cohos that were from the Quinault River that I buy from this company called Quinault Tribal Enterprises, which is a native-owned, native-operated small fishery up there on the Quinault River in Taloha, Washington. And, you know, I mean, so if you want to spend the big bucks, you get the king salmon from Alaska because the price is way higher. Not that much, but a good bit. And then if you want to go smaller, you get the coho. And you've got, like, two beautiful fish harvested both in the United States, you know, and just perfectly delicious, you know. Mm. And then we also have that rock cod there. We have, you know, last week we had swordfish that came from Dr. Dish, like 130-pound sword that came in the door hole that I had to go over there and, like, break down into steaks. You know, it's just exciting and it's fun. And like, the idea of knowing that all this stuff is harvested within a couple of hundred miles of Los Angeles proper, I think it's exciting, it's different. And, you know, Jonathan Gold talked about it when he wrote about Providence recently, that the food tastes like Los Angeles. And I think that is, you know, that might not be the goal that I had, like, with all of this and, you know, bringing in much more local fish. But if that's the case, then I'm happy about that. You know what I mean? Because, you know, there's no reason why LA can't have more of a regional sort of, like, flavor. And fish and shellfish are certainly part of that.
Yeah. I mean, but what about, and not to throw a corkscrew in it, but great for New York, great for the coast. How do you solve that problem once you get to the middle of America, like, when there are no oceans, there is no local, you can't just go out to the Pacific.
Right.
And the supply chain is like, well, if I'm going to get it from 2,000 miles away, why not get it from 5,000 miles away? How do you start shifting that perception and that supply chain?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Anytime you talk about, like, sustainable food systems, scale is always the question.
Right. And it works for beef because you can have local beef in the middle of America because you just need a pasture. Mm-hmm. But how do you apply that to the same thing where you actually need a body of water?
Well, I mean, the bottom line is you're going to have to ship things.
Sure.
You know what I mean? You're going to have to, I mean, FedEx will get you anything in 24 hours. At least that's the model that they built their world on. So, you know, I mean, I suppose that's the answer. But then, you know, people also argue about the sustainability of flying fish from coast to coast and that kind of stuff.
Sure.
You know, honestly, I do still believe, though, you know, firmly that you know, if you're in Dubuque, you're still better off to buy, you know, shrimp that were harvested in the Gulf,
100%.
Fresh or frozen, than you are, you know, shrimp that were raised in Laos or Cambodia or Vietnam.
Right.
You know, because you can rest assured of their quality and their purity and that they will be what they're supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know.
So I have to ask, you have number one restaurant in LA, mm-hmm. an amazing empire, changing the way people eat seafood, think about the seafood, talk about seafood, look, sustainability. Where do you go from here? What's next? Like, is it just get bigger or?
I don't know. I mean, right now, you know, I'm spending a lot of time focusing on Cape Seafood because we have just hired Sarah and taken on the whole Dr. Dish thing. So honestly, I really want to focus on that. I really want to focus on, like, on building what we've started, you know, with Dr. Dish and trying to, you know, really promote more, you know, local seafood and, you know, certainly wild seafood. And I don't know. I feel like it's, you know, it's probably it's probably more relevant than what I'm doing, like, within the four walls of the restaurants, you know, and because I, you know, I mean, you can accomplish whatever in a, you know, a good, you can accomplish things within the context of the restaurant, but, like, it, you know, I don't know. I feel like the, with Dr. Dish and with, like, pushing this whole idea of, you know, trying to buy more sustainably and trying to buy traceable fish and all that kind of stuff, I feel like that sets a more of a model, more of an example for you know, for the industry.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, it's one thing to do a very incredible fine dining mm-hmm. restaurant. That's one set of stakes. But to go out and change the way that people think about supply chain and fishing and a very basic knowledge of the way that people get what they eat, that's a whole other level of, like, being a force of change.
Yeah, but I find it like, honestly, just as exciting as what I do, you know, what I do here at Providence or at Connie and Ted's, because I feel like it, you know, in some, like, very, very small way, it makes a bit of a difference, and that's, you know, that's important, because, like, our generation and the generation that's below us, as chefs, as restaurateurs, as people in the food business, we are the ones that are going to, like, make the change. Sure. And we're the ones that are going to move the needle one way or the other. And my hope, obviously, would be that we move it in a positive direction and that we, you know, we ensure or try to ensure that there will be, you know, wild fish and fishermen, you know, plying the waters of our coast here in the United States for generations to come. And, you know, we have to make that change now. I mean, that's just, it really is kind of the bottom line.
Yeah.
It, you know, there are reports that suggest that, like, if we start to make these changes within 10 years, that many of the currently threatened species will come back to a place where they can be harvested sustainably. And so, I mean, that's an important goal. And, like, I want to be a part of, like, helping to ensure that that is what actually takes place, as opposed to, like, moving the needle in the other direction. And with this current administration that's just been voted in, I feel like we're at a, you know, in terms of environmental policy and like, on a much larger scale than just fisheries, but environmental policies with regard to climate change and will also determine, like, our course and our path for the next generation, because, you know, we don't do more if we don't stick with the Paris Accords and do more with regards to climate change. Rising sea temperatures and ocean acidification will threaten the very existence of everything that lives in the sea. And, like, once you start to mess with the foundation and you do irreparable damage to the food chain there, which there's starting to be evidence of due to ocean acidification and rising sea temperature, then everything is at risk. And so, you know, you can protect species with fisheries management and regulation all you want, but if you don't do something to ensure that the sea itself remains a healthy place and a viable environment for, like, species big and small, then you're really fucking with everything.
You can say you're fucked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just was reading in the New York Times, I think, like, one of the people that he's putting up for Secretary of the Interior is Sarah fucking Palin. Like, I mean, could you imagine the hell that she would rot to this earth if that were the case? I mean, she is...
The guy who wants to work for the EPA is a global climate change denier.
Yeah, half the people that he's putting up are all from the fossil fuel industry. You know, like, how are those people ever going to do anything, like, that to positively affect what's going on with climate change? It's insane. And, like, when you sit here as a you know, a chef or someone who values food, even if you're not in the business, but, you know, and you think about those are the people that could potentially be making policy that will shape the way our world looks like for the generation to come, for at least the next 4 years, it's fucking horrifying.
Especially since we've literally got the world to agree on one thing.
Yeah.
And which is the most insane thing. Like, we finally...
Right.
Finally,
and it's only a set of goals, actually.
Yeah,
you know, like, we're not even there yet.
Yeah.
It's we've agreed to work towards these things, which are important. So, I don't know. It's just... It's incredibly scary. And, you know, I try to talk less about, like, the whole climate change issue and ocean acidification and rising sea temperature, because, like... If that's your only focus, then you can lose sight of, like, some of the smaller issues that also are important. But the truth is like, there's that whole overarching thing that really will affect, you know, the viability of all of the species that we currently gather from the sea as food, much more than overfishing or poor regulation. You know what I mean? So You know, because, I mean, climate change and OA, ocean acidification, will do way more damage than you could ever really do with a fishing vessel. You know
right.
what I mean?
Right. Well, Chef, I appreciate the work that you're doing. I appreciate
Thanks.
The change that you're making. If people want to find out more about the restaurant or just any of the programs they're involved with, where can they go?
I don't know. I'll write a manifesto and I'll get back to you and I'll let you know.
Okay.
but you could go to our website, I guess.
And what's the website?
ProvidenceLA.com.
All right. Well, Chef, congratulations on everything.
Thank you.
Thank you for the hard work you're doing.
Thanks.
We have another song. I don't know if we've ever had a reggae band on, but we've definitely had some punk bands. So we'll play some punky stuff. Here live on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
Thank you.
Have you tasted the world's best cheese? Grand Cru Sauchois is the 2016 World Cheese Champion. Our partners at Roth, Wisconsin make this gorgeous alpine-style cheese in the rolling hills of Greene County, Wisconsin. Grand Cru Sauchois is produced by hand in Swiss copper vats and finished by aging on spruce planks. The quality milk and careful craftsmanship bring out the award-winning light floral notes, nutty undertones, a hint of fruitiness, and a mellow finish. Perfect with Riesling and Muscat, Grand Cru Sauchois is a guaranteed hit for any occasion. Check out their other offerings at rothcheese.com. You'll discover Buttermilk Blue and their newest release, Prairie Sunset, the golden-hued love child of Mimolet and Gouda. You'll also find recipes like the Raclette Reuben and tomato tartlets. Everything you need to know about the world's best cheese is at rothcheese.com.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We have Chris from Pop Etc. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I wanted to read a quote that you said and read it back to you.
I'm quoting myself.
I'm quoting yourself.
Okay.
We spent so long writing the new record, not knowing. In the end, what made it come together was distance. Experienced a lot during the making of the record. It's a souvenir of that period of time. Really fitting for what you would say is a four-year process of putting this record together. Let's go back. Where were you 4 years ago when you started the process of writing hundreds and hundreds of songs for this new endeavor?
I think at that time we'd been a band for a while. I'd been making music for years and kind of got caught up in the cycle of just making an album, touring, going back in, making an album, and not really being patient with kind of my artistic or whatever you want to call it desires, and just kind of was stuck in that grind. And I think we just hit a wall with it and realized we needed to chill for a minute and write at our own pace and not set any kind of deadlines that forced us to end or cut short our creative process.
A lot of the creative process, people will say, come from constraint, time, resources, etc. And you said that formerly your writing process was maybe 15, 20 songs at a time. What did cutting off all constraint do? Was it at first scary, or did it feel like you were falling just like through space and time? Or how did it make you feel once you were like, when it's done, and having no idea when you said that?
Yeah, I mean, at first it was just liberating because, like I said, we were kind of in that grind, and then just to let go of that and say, okay, we're not going to schedule any tours, we're not going to schedule any release dates or anything that would make us finish it. It was just, we felt free, you know, we could just do whatever we wanted, try lots of different things. We weren't thinking about an album per se. We were just writing and making music that we loved. And as time went on, I think it became harder. The fear of never knowing when it was going to be finished started creeping its way into the process.
Was that like year three or month two? Yeah,
I mean, it's hard to say. I think it was probably, it's a roller coaster. It's kind of like in the second week, it probably came up a little bit, but then you forget about it and move on. I remember it just kind of increasingly making its way into our mind as we got into that, whatever, second or third year of just writing and writing and writing.
And you changed the band name, but did you also change the process of writing songs through this?
We did it, but it didn't coincide with the band name change exactly. I mean, even as the Morning Benders, we did two albums, and the process for those two albums was quite different. The first one, I was kind of just a lot of the songs I'd already written by myself and recorded on my own, and didn't even have a band at the beginning of that album. Whereas for Big Echo, the second album, we had a band, and that was more of a band process. And so it's kind of changed all the time. And as a songwriter, I've always just wanted to keep trying different things. So that was kind of the plan forever, just to change the process as it seemed fit.
And do you feel that you're still a band if you don't have a record out, if you're not going on tour? Did there feel a time where Pop Etc. was more just a concept or kind of an intangible, less like something that was a physical thing that you could take out onto the road or share with people?
I mean, it's definitely a band in that when we changed the name, part of the reason we did that is one of our members left, and the three of us that were left was me, our drummer Julian, and my brother John. And the three of us have been playing for a long time now, and the Morning Benders went through many incarnations, lots of different band members, and the three of us have now been the longest that I've ever made music with. And as a result, the band, Pop Etc. as a band, is the three of us, and everything we do goes through all three of us. We all sign off on everything, and it's a very, our decision-making process is very collective. So in that way, it is a band.
And how did you feel about going from solo writing, being able to kind of control that, to having a group decision and group input? And how did that change the music? Obviously, different influences, different musical influences. But where do you think that took the songs in both a good way and a bad way?
I mean, I think collaboration really only makes things better. there aren't a lot of negatives there. The hard part was letting go of that control, for sure. I mean, starting off when I made our first album, I wanted to do everything myself, and I got a job at a studio so I could engineer it because I didn't want an engineer messing with it, and I started learning how to mix and just all that stuff, you know? And slowly I realized that if you can find people that you trust and bring into your circle of trust or whatever, then being able to collaborate with people that you rely on is really not only can trust but are inspired by their ideas as well. That's the best, I think.
And then within the collaboration process of the new batch of songs, when did you feel that the new sound or the new record began to take shape? I mean, you can't say like songs 1 through 40 were throwaways, but
yeah.
Where did that begin to enter into the sound and begin to formalize where you thought this might be the beginning of what comes next?
I mean, there's a couple of things. One of the aspects that brought it together was really just writing a ton of songs and then listening through them, kind of revisiting them every few months and being like, okay, there's like a certain strand that's running its way through this song and this song and this song. And they weren't even necessarily written close to each other. You know, the Souvenir has songs that were written like 3 years ago and some that were written a year ago, right before the album was released. So that it was kind of gradually being figured out through all the songs we were writing. The other thing that really kind of made the album more cohesive is I do a lot of the writing and demoing on my own. And when we start kind of earmarking songs to say like, okay, this might make sense for the album, then all three of us get more involved and we start fleshing them out and going to the studio and recording everything. And at that point you start hearing all three of our personalities imbued in the song. And that kind of started making the album come together. Does that make sense?
It does. Can we hear a song?
Yeah, let's do it.
What are you
going to
play first?
Those songs.
Yeah.
I'm going to do a song called Vice from our album, Souvenir.
Say I'm on your side, I'm trying to help you. Say you got answers, you're gonna help me soon. And I know there's darkness in your heart. We're both content to play our parts. Cause you got that advice that I like. No matter how hard I fight, it's a hold of me. And every time that I say it's the last, before I know it, I'm back. It takes a hold of me right now. Oh, 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 oh. I could give it all up. See, I made up my mind. Something in my blood that makes me cross those lines. And I know there's darkness in my heart too. We're both content to play our parts. Cause you got that advice that I like. No matter how hard I fight, takes a hold of me, and every time that I say it's the last, before I right. It takes a hold of me, and every time that I say it's the last, before I know it, I'm back. It takes a hold of me right now.
The video for Vice is pretty food-centric.
Yeah, it is.
The best thing about it is the yolk cutting. How hard is it to cut a yolk?
It's hard to keep it on the thing, on the cutting board.
Yeah. I mean, how many takes is it to get the yolk in the way that you wanted it?
How many takes?
Yeah.
While I was making the dish?
Yeah.
I mean, when you're cutting it for the movie or for the video, that's it. We're just trying to, we kind of cheated it. You know, we're trying to just get the right angle. When I'm doing it for, you know, fried rice or something, I usually get on the first try.
What is the inspiration behind, I mean, the song, you know, lightly lines up with it, but what was the inspiration for the food theme and the cooking and the disappearing meals?
We were thinking a lot for what the video for Vice could be, and the song's about, you know, addiction or having vices in your life. And there's a lot of those things that kind of come to mind that a lot of people have problems with, like drugs or alcohol or whatever. And we just thought it would be not only cliche, but not really capturing exactly what we wanted to capture in that song if we were to do something like that. Because what I was thinking about with Vice and with a lot of the songs on Souvenir is that you can really have an unhealthy relationship to any kind of pattern of behavior. And so that goes for things that you think of as wholesome, like food, eating, or exercise or something. There's lots of things that you can get addicted to that on the surface are healthy, good things or necessary things like food, and take them to an unhealthy extreme. So we kind of wanted to show that.
You talk about being addicted to writing music. Is that unhealthy?
It can be, yeah.
In what way?
In that I have a sense of happiness and fulfillment that kind of hinges on being writing songs and being productive with music, and I hold myself to a pretty high standard. So often, like, if I don't write a song for a day, I'll feel like I wasted the day, which isn't necessarily true.
Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo said the same thing. He draws a lot, and he said if he doesn't draw every day, he feels like there's like a gaping hole, or something emerging out from that can only be filled by doing the act.
Yeah. Totally.
So how do you balance that with life on the road or all the other things that come in and fill the void of being a band along with, you know, being productive, being creative?
Yeah, well, I mean, being on the road is the hardest part because I try to be productive with writing and doing that. And I definitely start ideas, but it's hard to kind of work on them, you know, the workflow is always interrupted by various things. But besides that, it's just kind of finding enough people to work with and enough different projects to work on that you're not always just a slave to your band schedule, you know? So lately I've kind of been producing and writing for other artists, and that allows me to not only find homes for all these songs that I write every day, but also just to get fresh inspiration and see how other people make music, and all that stuff is really, it keeps it fun and fresh.
From the collaboration process and the producing process, what are some of the things that you've learned from other people that you've incorporated into yourself or began to look at differently through for your own creative process?
Oh, I mean, everyone I work with is so different. So, and now I'm, you know, I've taken all the parts that I liked from different people's process. So I'm a Frankenstein of everything I've worked on. But I don't know. I mean, seeing how certain like engineers work in the studio that are very mathematically minded and how they're honing in on certain sounds and making sure that this buzz isn't there or the way an acoustic guitar sounds isn't, or the way that an instrument actually sounds in the space is captured to the tape or hard drive or whatever, however you're recording. There's a lot of kind of technical aspects of making music that I didn't initially connect with, because I always was just a songwriter and I like to just play and sing, So I've learned a lot about that side of the process through various, you know, engineers, producers, and mixers we've worked with. And I've started to see how you can bring a really creative, artistic approach to things that seem very mechanical and mathematical, you know?
Do you find yourself doing something and be like, oh yeah, that's how John does it, or that's how like Matt does it, or does it just fold in and become part of yourself?
I think I've noticed that when I'm first, like, fresh off working with someone, and I'll find myself doing something and be like, oh, that's similar to... But after a while, I mean, it just... Who knows? I don't know where any of this stuff comes from. You're influenced by so many things, everything you come into contact with, you know?
Can we hear another song?
Yeah. Are you ready?
I'm very ready. What's this one called?
I'm going to do a song called What Am I Becoming? Never knew you were after me. Now even when I'm alone, I feel like somebody's watching me. I couldn't smell the smoke, and now I watch the flames. I couldn't push myself to quit. Oh, this dangerous game. There's a reason people die out here. I can't keep living this way. I can't keep living this way. Oh, I've been running so long. These shadows start to feel like home. Oh, I know it's backwards. Been scared so long. Can't recall what I started running from. What am I becoming? What am I becoming? Tell me that's enough. But I got a hunch I'll be back again. 'Cause even if I could escape, paying with something I shouldn't spend. I couldn't smell the smoke, and now I watch the flames. I lock myself out here again. Oh, this fruitless game. All these people are gonna die out here. I can't keep living this way. I can't keep living this way. Oh, I've been running so long. These shadows start to feel like home. Oh, I know it's backwards. Been scared so long. Can't recall what I started running from. What am I becoming?
For the new record, you built your headphone cave. Can you explain what that is?
We needed a name for our studio and in our apartment, and
no one can see air quotes.
Yeah,
on the radio, yeah. But studios
kind of
quotes.
A studio. I mean, studios they're changing all the time.
Yeah, loosely defined.
Loose term.
We had a studio in two different apartments that I've lived in now. For Souvenir, it was the same one for the whole time, but I moved recently. And we often got noise complaints, so we were all three of us with our headphones sitting around the computer. That's why we called it Headphone Cave.
And what was the setup there? I mean, like you said, studios are so different now. I mean, a laptop is a studio, so what did you do to maybe take it a little bit out of the air quote realm?
Yeah, I mean, I started recording on my laptop on the road, and that's kind of what got me into that again, because I'd worked at a studio before, but that was always kind of... with all their gear, and we recorded our first couple albums to tape. So I learned engineering and that sort of thing from a more analog perspective. So when I started recording on my laptop, it was just a matter of getting back to some of the gear that introduces, a more natural or chaotic element to recording. So that meant like getting more instruments that we could record and play. I got a piano for our apartment that we recorded on, and some old mics and a couple of pre's and a compressor, a bunch of synths.
So was this one done on all laptop, or did you move back to tape for this one as well?
We did it all on computer. It wasn't a laptop, but yeah, all computers. Yeah, I mean, there's a certain freedom to that we really like now. With tape, it just... I love the sound of tape. I love the kind of natural compression that you get from hitting tape. I don't like the process of recording to tape. It's horrible. It's so slow. Anytime you want to edit something, it's this whole to-do. I like being able to move quickly, and if you have an idea, not be slowed down or paralyzed by the way you're recording.
I mean, it goes back to the overarching theme for this of no constraint.
Yeah.
Nothing self-imposed, just pure creative process. So to go back to where we started and following the strands, how did you begin to narrow down what became Souvenir? What were some of the more themes that jumped out along the way? And what was it that took you from the four-year process to say, here we go, now I feel that I'm ready to become a more tangible form of myself?
I don't know if I've made that decision yet, but
none of us do. But whatever,
as far
whatever.
As Souvenir goes, I spoke a little to this before, but part of it was finding the set of songs that the three of us all loved. Hmm. So there are a lot of songs that I sent to them, and I was like, "Guys, this is the one. I love this. This is great." And they would write back, not really feeling it.
Did you get the email? So, I sent it in an email.
Yeah. Why aren't you guys responding to me? That happened a lot. And a big part of what made Souvenir, and what kind of I feel like drives our band at this point is the way that we all curate what we put out. So that was a huge part of it. And then thematically, there were definitely a few different strands of kind of, it's weird calling them themes, but kind of emotional content that was consistent through lots of different songs. There's a few different albums we probably could have funneled songs into. But there was something about the songs on Souvenir that all felt very close to us in terms of what we were going through at that time. And I think a process of, like, in the way we were making music for a while, as I talked about earlier, and we were thinking about this process as a different phase for us, we'd also just lived life longer, and we were thinking about our time together and what we'd gone through the 5 or 6 years prior as a band.
And will this process continue for the next record? Will it be another 3-4 years off of Unconstrained, or do you feel that you've now... Do you feel that you've now gotten to a new place where the writing process has evolved to the point where it is, at least in this time, something that you could stick to or adhere to, and it doesn't need to go out into the wild as much for the next record?
I have learned from my mistakes, and that I won't promise that it's going to come out anytime. I don't know if it'll come out sooner or later or whatever.
Sorry, record label, if you're listening.
My best guess is that we do feel there's some momentum to the process that we started, and we've written a lot since Souvenir came out, and we had a lot of songs that we have written in the last couple of years that we've come back to and kind of reinvigorated. So we feel productive.
Non-committal, but that's the most commitment that you can make. Yeah. Well, I want to make sure we have time for one more song.
Yeah.
Where can people find the record? How can people follow you? Do you have social media?
Yeah, we're all over all the stuff. Find us. We like talking to people on social media. That's kind of the best part of it.
You have a good dialogue with the people?
We do, yeah. And it's funny that a lot of artists are... entities on social media do not.
Yeah.
So,
I feel it's like the easiest way. I mean, I'll put it another way. If someone takes the time to, it isn't just to like you, but to write you a letter, how great is that someone took the time to do that?
It's amazing. Yeah.
And
I, I always encourage, like, people will write us stuff about how they use this song in, like, their wedding or some event or whatever, and I'll be like, take a video, show. Like, I want to see more of that stuff, because that's the side of things that kind of, that really motivates us to keep working, seeing that our music's connecting with people, and we don't get to see any of that, really, if it wasn't for social media. And
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. I think, like, having a dialogue is the best part. Yeah. Especially if you're in a van for 12 hours.
Yeah, it really helps.
We want to thank Providence for being on the show earlier. And if you have a moment, please vote for Snacky Tunes for Taste Awards, Best Radio Show and Best Podcast. Voting closes on December 20th. It's bit.do/stvote. This is the last show of the year. You are the last guest of the year.
I'm so honored.
Thank you for doing this. We will
Thanks
be
for having me.
Thank you for being on here. This is a wonderful way. Process is such a good thing to think about going into the holidays, especially when you have all that downtime.
Yeah, and New Year's, got your resolutions coming up.
Yeah. Do you have any planned? Can you pre-plan resolutions?
I'm going to try to make less, start writing less, stop holding myself to unhealthy standards of...
You just undid the whole interview. That is unfortunate.
Yeah, but you guys don't know how insane I am.
Oh, okay.
With that.
Fair enough.
I want to just lead a more balanced, healthy life.
Balance is good. Let's go. Yeah. How about this? We'll go for balance.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah? Okay. Yeah. That sounds like a good one.
Yeah.
That sounds doable, better than any extreme.
Yeah.
What's the name of the last song you're going to take us out?
I'm going to go, as we talk about the future, I'm going to go back in time.
Oh, perfect.
To an oldie for us, an oldie where I come from, called Excuses.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening. Thanks to all the people who supported us this year and sent us nice notes. And as Chris encourages, please write us. We'll write you back. We got some time on our hands with the holidays upon us. And we will be back next year with a whole nother season of Snacky Tunes. Shout out to Darren and the whole family. And Chris, will you do us the honor of taking us out one last time?
Okay. Here we go.
Thanks so much.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat & 3.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you save a little room for dessert.